Attendees are in listen-only mode.
Hi everyone, my name is John Bone. Some of you may have met me and some of you may know me. First of all, let me make some apologies. I'm filling in tonight for Dimna and Ian. We've all been at 3-day Ultimate Boot Camp in Melbourne, and they're currently flying home, so unfortunately they won't be able to fulfil their obligations to answer questions tonight, but they've asked me to fill in for them. So I do apologise. I'm a little bit of a novice with the question and answers, but I have a list of the questions here, and I hope that I can answer all of the questions satisfactorily for you. So please be patient, and I'm sure we'll get through it. And at the end, they've asked me to do a brief presentation on investing in the US, and that's my area of expertise, as some of you may know, and we'll cover a number of points in discussing that. First of all, let me say that in relation to the comments that I'm going to make tonight, I'm not a financial advisor, I'm not an accountant, so I'm not qualified to give you advice, and I would always suggest that when you're looking at investing your money in real estate or any other kinds of investments for that matter, that you seek professional advice. So that being the case, we'll move on to the first question, which is from Mark. Now, Mark has a fairly complicated question in relation to the advantages of using a bank equity trust. And according to Dimna, this question was answered by professionals in the last webinar. So although it's a fairly complicated question, they've asked me just to direct Mark or anybody else who's interested in investing with bank equity trusts to have a look at the last webinar, which apparently covers the subject in a great deal of detail. So that was the first question, and that was, although it was probably a very difficult question, it was probably the easiest one for me to answer. The next one's from Tom, and I'll just read out part of the question. I'm able to access cash which he has in a company. Then he has the potential to do a small development with the cash that's inside the company, but not inside a trust. Now, in this particular case, what we would suggest you do is to not do the development inside a company. There are a number of disadvantages in using a company. First of all, there's the fact that the company doesn't get the 50% capital gains exemption. So what we'd suggest in this particular case is that if the money is with the company, then you use the company to lend the money to a trust, a discretionary trust with a corporate trustee. If the money's not in the company already, then wherever that money is or whoever's holding that money should be able to lend it directly to the discretionary trust and have the discretionary trust purchase the property and to do the investment. That way, the finance will be in the name of the trust, but the guarantors will obviously still need to sign on the loan, or at least the directors of the corporate trustee will still be needed as guarantors, but that would be the case if you were doing the project in a company anyway. The directors of the company would still be required to sign guarantees for the loan. But the big issue is really with doing any kind of development inside a company is primarily the lack of the 50% capital gains exemption, and also one of asset protection. The asset protection is something that a lot of people don't realise, but when you're dealing with a company, the directors of the company are liable in the event that they trade while insolvent or fraudulently, but there is another proviso too, and that is that they've acted irresponsibly or negligently. So if you were doing a development and somebody was to fall and injure themselves, and that was through the directors, or proven to be through the directors' negligence, then they could attack your personal assets. So using companies for any kind of real estate venture is certainly not recommended, and I hope that answers the question. My dog seems to think that it does. The next question is from Audrey. Now, Audrey's question is also a little bit complicated, and it's a little bit involved, and I'll just go through it a little bit at a time. She's got two companies and trusts. One is holding a property which has a fully paid off mortgage. So there are rental income tax implications. Well, that's certainly the case. So if you're deriving an income from the rental property through the trust, then there are certainly going to be tax implications. But you can minimise the effect of the tax implications simply because of the power of the trust and the ability to disperse the funds to beneficiaries to your best interests, to minimise the tax, and that's obviously the power of the tax of the trust structure. It was her principal place of residence in the past, but starting from this year, it's been used as an investment property. Now, this is an interesting point because a lot of people do this. A lot of people transfer their PPRs into an investment property. But the capital gains tax is a very big issue when you do this. From the time that property becomes an investment property, then capital gain starts to become an issue. So at the point you transfer this property from your PPR, from the status of being a PPR to the status of being an investment property, you really need to get a property valuation. And you need to get a very, very advantageous property valuation, so the valuation is as high as possible, and that will minimise any potential capital gain that you have in the future if you elect to sell the property. So you will definitely have to pay tax on the income. Now, she's now got a new principal home which has got a mortgage and obviously can't claim the interest on that loan. She's also got a second company which she used for business operations in the past, and with a substantial loan to the company, and the company unfortunately was unsuccessful, and a large part of that money, if not all of it, was lost as a result of the joint venture business. What she's asking is, company and trust structure that had the loss be used as a piggy bank company or piggy bank trust. Now, this is something that you perhaps need to talk to an accountant or lawyer about, particularly an accountant in the first case. I'll just discuss that in the first instance. The first instance is that you have a substantial loss to account for. Now, losses can be accumulated in two ways. One can be an income loss, and one can be a capital loss. And you can only write off gains, you can only write off income gains against income losses, and you can only write off capital gains against capital losses. So the first thing you need to do in this particular case is to establish with your accountant whether this loan that you've, and this money that you've lost is a capital loss or an income loss. But all you can do then is use other discretionary trusts, and when you have an appropriate gain, whether it be a capital gain or an income gain, move it up into this trust that has the loss in order to absorb it, and that will minimise the amount of tax that you've got to pay. But using it for any future investment deal is something where there is certainly an element of risk, because you have any contingent liability as a result of the failed business may be transposed onto the new investment deal. So you need to be very careful about using trusts in that way, or even companies in that way, when they've been used in the past for any kind of business activity. That if there is any kind of liability as a result of that activity in the past, then it may affect investments in the future. So my recommendation there, Audrey, is to be very, very careful about doing that. But certainly seek professional advice from Calvin. Certainly should be able to advise you whether there's any inherent risk in that particular scenario. Now, I have another question from Eileen. Eileen has purchased a property off the plan in Sydney, and she did that in 2012. It's a two-year project, and it's due to settle early November. Unfortunately, she made the classic mistake, like many people do, before they've spoken to Dimna, and she's bought it in her own name. And she's now thinking about changing the ownership to a trust name. Unfortunately, if you do that, there is going to be a stamp duty issue, and there's also going to be a capital gains issue. Sorry, I've just lost my, might be a moment. Yes, sorry, I just lost my screen there for a moment. Yeah, the transferring the contract into a new name, a trust name, is certainly going to mean that you're going to pay double stamp duty, and it's also going to mean that there will be a capital gains tax event will be triggered. There's probably not going to be an issue in relation to GST, but there certainly is in the other issues. So. So really, when it boils down to it, you've really got a choice about how you handle this, and it's really just a question of whether you're prepared to accept the risk in leaving it in your own name, or whether you want to pay the costs essentially and move it into a trust. And now that's a personal issue. You really need to talk to your accountants and your legal advisors about that. In these particular cases, in these particular kinds of deals, there's probably not enough money in it to consider moving it from your own name, but if there's a potential there to sell it for a profit, then that's probably the best way out, is to basically cut and run and, sell it, take whatever profit's there, if there's any profit there, and move on to another deal. But that's just one alternative to get out of it. She's also saying, now one other thing too, by the way, when you're talking about tax, she's asked about the fact that the reason why she did it was because her accountant recommended that it be put in her own name so that she can claim tax against her income, the amount of tax she's paying. And clearly she's paying too much tax, and that's why people do that, and then they claim depreciation and do all those sorts of things that people do in order to reduce their personal taxation. Dibner's comment that she gave me here is paying tax is good. Now, Dibner's a bit like that. She sees paying tax as being something that we should all be really proud of. The more tax we pay, obviously, the more money we're making, and that's a good thing. So we shouldn't be too scared of our tax liabilities. But unfortunately, accountants get a little bit too tied up in it. They encourage us to take risks with our personal liability by going into these kinds of schemes, and mostly they do that simply because they're not aware of the legal ramifications of getting involved in those kinds of transactions. That generally happens with accountants who are not really familiar with the pros and cons of real estate investing. So if you've got those kinds of accountants, then my suggestion is always to go and find an accountant who deals with real estate developers and real estate investors and has that kind of experience. They will save you more money than they cost you in the long term. Now, she goes on to say that she's paid cash, 10% cash, and needs to pay more on settlement. I'm just having a bit of difficulty here understanding the question. Her accountant says it is fine to have a high level of debt, and that is certainly the case. Having a high level of debt against the property is a form of asset protection. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that at all. If it's in your own name, and in this particular case it is, that property is at risk simply if you're sued. Any asset in your name is going to be exposed if you're sued for any reason. Driving a car while you're intoxicated or doing anything ultimately puts all of these assets at risk. And that's the reason why Dibner will always recommend that these things be done inside a trust. And as I said, transferring it across to a trust is purely and simply a matter for you as to whether you want to wear the stamp duty and the capital gains tax implications as a result of making the change. I hope that answers the question as best we can. Now, we also have a question here from Mark. Now, Mark has got a very, very big project on his plate. He's working with a deal with a landowner with the possibility of a 12-unit development. Now, this is it's complicated because the land value is $2 million, the build cost is $6 million, the gross realization is going to be somewhere like $10 million. So we're talking about a very, very large investment. And from the way Mark words this, Mark doesn't have the funds in order to do this. So he's looking at the prospect of putting together a syndicate to basically buy, essentially buy the land, although he doesn't say buy the land, but putting an option on the land, paying out the owner's loan on the land so that the land is free of any debt, and then using that to obtain commercial finance in order to do the build and then any subsequent sale. Well, this is something that you really need to talk to Calvin about. Calvin from Pacific Law is certainly the expert when it comes to these kinds of option deals and certainly options of this size. But I will make some comments just from personal experience. One of the points that Mark makes is that he needs to establish a syndicate of investors to cover $1.8 million of debt on the land in order to secure the finance. Now, I'm part of a land syndicate. There are 17 people in the land syndicate. We, in total, have contributed a very similar sum of money, approximately $1.8 million, against this particular block of land. It is has been and continues to be the biggest disaster I've ever been involved in when it comes to land deals. And that's simply because having 17 investors, in our case, each having invested $100,000, it's almost impossible to get consensus to do anything, you know, even something relatively simple. And then when it comes to paying things like land tax and these kinds of bills, getting money out of 17 people has always proven to be a little bit difficult too. So it has, from my personal experience, these kinds of syndicates are really, really complicated things to do anything with. And if you set up a structure with the joint venture, with a joint venture from the landowner, then you're going to have perhaps a unit trust in order to establish the ownership or the shares in relation to all of the investors. So getting loans then becomes a very, very complicated process because all of these people are going to have to be on the loan documents. And that in itself is going to be a very, very unwieldy process. Now, somebody like Calvin at Pacific Law is probably the best person to give you some kind of advice as to how you best handle that number of investors, if that is in fact how many you would have. But even if you split the $1.8 million up into three or four investors, you're still going to have issues in relation to getting people to agree on relatively simple things, and particularly when it comes to land subdivisions and you know, how should it be subdivided and, you know, all those kind of issues. So it is very complex, and for that reason, I would certainly say you've got to seek professional advice and talk to Calvin. And I hope that answers a question for you, Mark. I've also got a question from Ali, I think. Ali had a bit of a problem with Pacific Law here in Victoria. I'm from Victoria, and I've actually tried to deal with Pacific Law here too. I'm not sure if I've tried to deal with the same person, but she says that she didn't have much or didn't get much assurance in dealing with them. She says here, I did not get much assurance with it, and a fixed price structure could not be offered like Calvin would, and this is in relation to an option contract. Dibner's suggestion here is that you contact Calvin and give him the feedback. It's very important that you give feedback. Obviously, Calvin operates out of Brisbane, and he's relying on the people in other states, and of course, his reputation is at stake. So giving him the feedback about these kinds of difficulties that you have, and it doesn't matter whether it's Calvin at Pacific Law or Investor Loans, you should, if you're having difficulty, get hold of the principals involved, give them the feedback that you're not particularly happy with the circumstance. Now, in this particular case, I know a little bit about the person here at Pacific Law, and a few weeks ago he was actually in hospital and was having some sort of medical issue. So not that that's an excuse for poor performance, it's not, but I would imagine that he's had some things on his mind, and maybe that's part of the issue, so but by all means take it up with Calvin. Now, she also says that she went to council's planning register here in Victoria, Mangham. All right, I've lost my screen again. To find the contact details for people like who did the development. Now, when people like Ian and Dimna are doing demonstrations of about how you can do developments, they often show Queensland. Now, Queensland is, well, it seems to be at least well ahead of other states when it comes to finding out information about how developments are done and who the town planners and builders and all that kind of people were. Unfortunately, in Victoria, we've got privacy laws that prevent the council from publishing all that information. So here in Victoria, unfortunately, we miss out a little bit on that kind of information. It's not readily available. But what you'll find with a lot of councils is that the duty planning officer is often a very chatty person, and he's the person you need to get to know and get friendly with. So if you go into some of these councils and have a bit of a chat to them, and I've been into many of them, I know, for example, Geelong, for example, the people in the Geelong Council are extremely friendly, and they'll turn the screen around for you to have a look at. They won't tell you who the builders and town planners are, but they'll turn the screen around for you to have a look. So you just need to be friendly with them, go in there, ask simple questions, you'll get simple answers, and many times they're extremely helpful when it comes to getting that kind of information, even though they can't necessarily tell you directly that information. But you can also ask them for recommendations about town planners, and you don't need to ask them directly about town planners, just ask them which town planners do they prefer to deal with, for example. And many of the duty town planners will give that information, although in some cases they're not supposed to, but they will do that. They're often very talkative people, I've found. So you need to be a little bit positive when you're dealing with the councils. You need to be friendly. You need to think outside the square. And one other thing you can do too is that if there are developments going on in the area where you're planning, just go and have a chat to the people on the site. They'll often know who's doing things on other sites. I know that when I was doing the townhouse developments that I did in Nidri, all of the builders up and down the streets all knew who was doing what and who was doing what to whom, and it was just something that happened. And quite often you'll find the information that you want on notice boards in front of buildings anyway. So, you know, you can find this information out. You just need to be a little bit upfront with some of the people who are on the building sites and in the council offices. Also, have a question from Canwa. Now, Canwa doesn't own a PPR, and he's having difficulty getting a loan for his first investment property. And I guess there are a lot of Dimna students in that position as well. It can often be a very, very difficult place to start. When you don't have a PPR, you don't have any equity, and you may be short of serviceability as well. So getting into your first investment is always going to be a little bit difficult. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Now, he's asked how you can actually get into these kinds of deals with vendor financing or vendors leaving the money in the property. Really what you need to do is look at one of the things that you can do, for example, is look at trade dollars. You can buy trade dollars off the internet often at a discount, 20 cents in the dollar in some cases. See if the vendor will accept trade dollars with the view to subsequently changing those to real dollars in the future. So that's one alternative that Dimna suggested. You can ask Investor Loans is probably another place to go to and ask how they can possibly help you in that respect. But one of the things that you do need to do is that when the bank is looking at you from a loan perspective, they need to know that you've got the funds to complete. So When they're looking at giving you a loan, and let's say for argument's sake you're buying a property with an 80% LVR, they want to know that you've got the other 20% and that you've got the money to pay the stamp duty. So they're going to look at your bank balances in order to see that you've got the money to complete. Now, I'm not going to suggest, I'm going to suggest something here which is probably a little bit bent, I hate to use that word, but how you get that money into your bank account is entirely up to you. If you've got friends who can lend you $20,000 or $30,000 for a week or so, just so that you've got those funds in your on your bank statement, then that's something you need to look at doing. Even if it's a very, very short-term loan, undocumented loan from friends or family, get the money into your bank account so that you can prove to the banks that you can complete the transaction, and then you're going to have a little bit better chance of getting the finance in place. And then, of course, just repay the funds and go on with the vendor terms in exactly the way that Dimna did with vendor financing. Obviously, it's a little bit complicated if you want the vendor to give you the money before you actually settlement. He's not going to do that, but you know, you need to get the money into the bank account, even if it's only a short term. So that's probably one way to look at moving forward. And the other one, of course, is a joint venture relationship. And this is always going to be the easiest way to move forward in any type of transaction when you're short of any kind of part of the process, whether that's serviceability or whether it's equity or experience. You need to look for joint venture partners who can fill that gap for you, and that's going to be the best way to start every time. I've also got a couple of questions from Andre, and I think they're from the same person. Andre says he's been following strategies on renovations, granny flats and subdivisions in his current portfolio. He lives in Sydney, and from his research, the next capital city to grow is Brisbane. Well, that is certainly the case. I spent 4 weeks in Brisbane back in March, April, and there was an enormous amount of activity going on in Brisbane, but there's also an enormous amount of competition. And that competition is coming from a lot of Dimna students, strangely enough. Dimna students and Bob Anderson students are there in numbers looking for deals in that area, and I was one of them for a short time. So yes, Brisbane is certainly going to be a place where you're going to see some growth, but you're going to see some competition in finding the good properties. The granny flats legislation, he talks about renovation strategies that will work and the legal requirements in relation to granny flats in Brisbane. Granny flats certainly are a difficulty in some Brisbane councils, in the Brisbane area councils, but they are allowed in the Logan Council, Ipswich Council, and some other areas surrounding the Brisbane City Council. So if you're looking in Brisbane City Council, then you're certainly going to have difficulty with granny flats, but in Logan, which is to the south, and Ipswich, which is to the west, you're going to find a lot better opportunity to look at granny flats. He asks, what is your advice on investing interstate? Well, certainly if you're investing interstate, doing renovations interstate is a very, very difficult process. Not something that I would recommend. I think that Ian's done it before, but you really need a good, strong team in place. You need to have good project management skills, because you're going to be doing things like organising renovations, organising trades, online and on the phone, and that's going to be a little bit complicated. So trying to do that kind of strategy interstate is a little bit difficult. Doing subdivisions interstate is probably a little bit easier, because you're generally only going to be dealing with people like town planners and other kind of professionals like surveyors and those sort of people. And in many cases, if you deal with a town planner, they'll bring their team to the transaction anyway, and they'll get all of the other people that they need, like any kind of issues in relation to water, power or gas and any of those kind of issues, they'll bring their team to the transaction. So you're often only dealing with the town planner when it comes to doing those kinds of transactions interstate. So it's a little bit easier in that respect. He asks, if I can't do the above strategies, renovations, granny flats, can you recommend a house or townhouse or apartments? When you're looking at in any state, and it doesn't matter whether it's in your home state or in any other state, the key issue here in relation to what you're going to develop, whether it's a house or townhouse or apartment, really depends on the demand. You've really got to look at what people are buying, and you've got to basically think a little bit outside the square here. You've got to go into areas and look in areas. Let's take Brisbane, for example. In Brisbane, in the inner suburban areas, there's a lot of demand for townhouses now, so people are pulling down older houses on larger blocks and building infill, basically what they call infill housing, which is, you know, townhouses and dual occupancies at the rear of existing houses, or pulling down existing houses and building townhouses. But you've really got to do your market research to see what's selling in what area before you can really decide on what you should be doing. And to a large extent too, it depends on how much money you've got, because to pull a house down and do townhouse or apartments is obviously going to require a great deal of capital. It's going to require serviceability. So those kinds of deals, they can be lengthy in time. You've really got to know what you're doing, and to do that interstate is also a little bit difficult, but certainly possible. If you decided to buy an apartment, would you do it off plan or secondhand? He's asked. Well, buying an apartment secondhand is a good strategy, particularly if you do your research and you find small blocks of apartments. Now, Dimna's recommendation in that particular respect is apartments that are generally blocks of four, blocks of six, so you're not dealing with a lot of owners, and ones that have got very large sinking funds. So you need to look for rundown blocks where they've got large sinking funds, so that you can get in there and convince all of the owners that they need to spruce up, use the sinking funds to spruce it up and therefore increase the capital value of the whole block. And you not only do yourself a favour doing that, but you're doing them a favour as well, because you're increasing everybody's property value and you're increasing your own equity. So that's kind of the best place to start. If you're buying off the plan, then there's a danger that the market could move against you. Generally, when you're buying off a plan, you're buying 2 or 3 years in advance of the actual construction. So what you might find, and this is happening more and more in Melbourne, for example, people have bought off the plans in Docklands. The market has dropped substantially, so they're now sitting on a commitment to buy an apartment, which is now not worth what they have to pay, simply because the market's moved against them. And what's going to happen is that when the buyer goes to the bank in order to get a loan, the loan valuation is going to come in much lower than the contract price. So the buyer is going to have to find much more money than they would have anticipated right from the start. Even if the market is moving for you, and that is that the prices are going up, you run the risk depending on the wording in the contract, that what you could have is a developer who sees the fact that the market is moving up, and he's committed to sell to you at a price which is now much lower than he could get otherwise. So what he's going to try and do is to get out of that contract and not settle with you. So in all probability, he will stall the build to a point where he can exercise an option to basically pull out of the deal. So you've got to be very careful about those things. If you're buying off the plan, certainly an issue that you need to take up with somebody like Calvin at Pacific Law to make sure that if the market is moving in your favour, that the builder can't get out of it, and if it's moving against you, that you can. And even if you get out of those kind of deals, you want to be able to get out of them with a minimum of financial loss. So make sure that you contact a legal team. Any tips in suburbs and areas is one of the things he's asked. Well, this is basically grid variance analysis. It's a complicated process. You need to do due diligence in all these areas. So if you're talking about, I know you mentioned you lived in Sydney, but if you're looking at Sydney suburbs or Brisbane suburbs, you need to look at what the market's doing, what are people building, what are people buying, it's one thing to do to buy a property, but what you've got to make sure that what you're selling is what people want to buy and not what you want to sell. So you've got to start looking at doing that kind of analysis. You've got to get right down to the suburbs and even to areas in suburbs, because there are some areas in suburbs, particularly when you're looking at access to infrastructure. You want to make sure that you are buying properties that's, say, within walking distance of transport, whether that's bus stations or train stations or those sorts of things. If you're building townhouses, then that can be an issue for the people who live in townhouses. So you've really just got to do your grid variance analysis when it comes to suburbs and areas, and that's a complicated process. I think, as everybody knows, it's not easy to do. Now, it's also a question here in relation to the fact that Andre has five properties, all with loans, all with the one bank. The negatives are relatively simple here. If the bank decides that you have as much, they are holding as much risk as they want to in your particular case, you could go to them with a proposal to buy property number six and they're going to say no, simply because they feel that they're as exposed as they want to be to your investment strategy. So that's one of the main problems in dealing with the one bank. Now, you also have a problem in that if you're not able to meet your financial commitments in relation to those properties, then they will take them all, basically, and they'll put them all on the market and sell them all until the debts are satisfied. So having them with different banks in different structures means that if one bank wants to foreclose on you or stop you or do whatever they want to do to you, all of the others are going to remain untouched. Now, Andre goes on to say, if I declare bankruptcy with one bank and dealing with two banks, it will be very easy for Bank A to find out my assets in Bank B and access it. Well, that's not entirely the case. If you default on your loans with one bank, then they're not going to be able to attack the assets that are held by the other bank. But one assumes that if you can't pay your debts with one bank, then you can't pay them with either. So they're all going to come after you, and it really doesn't matter. If you declare bankruptcy, then as soon as you could be with have five properties with five banks, as soon as you declare bankruptcy, they're all going to come after you because they're all going to want their money. It's as simple as that. So you can't kind of declare bankruptcy with just one bank, unfortunately. It's not something that's going to happen. I hope that answers your question. Natasha has a question in relation to Mark Rolton. She's been to one of Mark Rolton's options seminars. Now, I've seen Mark Rolton present, and I think I understand a little bit about the way his options work. She basically says, at the point where the party who controls the land wants to exercise the option, is there a clause which would stop anyone else from gazumping in any way? Well, there is, and that's for you to have a caveat on the property. You protect your interests by having a caveat on the title, which means that the title can't change hands until the caveat is listed. Now, you need to get some legal advice here because there are different levels of caveats. If you have a caveat on the property which is agreed to both by the owner and by you, so that it's a, the owner is happy to have the caveat placed on the property, then that caveat will remain in place until you remove it, until both parties agree to remove it at least. But if you are able to prove that you have a reason to have a caveat on the property without the owner's consent, then you can have a caveat put on the title, but in many states and in many cases, that caveat has a time limit and it will expire. So you need to be a little bit careful about placing caveats on properties, and you definitely need to get a lawyer involved in having that done. But that's the way you protect your interests. There are penalties if the owner breaches the caveat and sells the property, but then the buyer and their lawyers would find themselves in a great deal of hot water as well, because they've purchased a property that's had a caveat on it. So that can get quite messy in a legal sense. So again, you need to be very careful about that. It's one of those things, there's no doubt that can happen. Lawyers make mistakes. Properties could change hands even though there's a caveat there, but the last thing you want to do is start getting involved in the Australian legal system. It's not exactly a friendly place to be. I've been there. Don't get involved. Try and stay out of it. Get a lawyer right from the start and make sure they know what they're doing, and Calvin and Pacific Law are certainly the people to do that. I think that's answered the question. Yes, I think so. Move on to the last one. Now, this is from Noel and Caroline. It's a fairly lengthy question. It's more about advice about developing a property in Western Melbourne. Now, it's 1,065 square metres. Currently has a good but slightly tired three-bedroom, two-and-a-half brick veneer low-set home on the front of the block, which is narrower at the front than the back. Their first development, always interesting to do something like this your first time round. Sounds very similar to what I did in my first one. They're considering renovating the existing house and building a low-set duplex at the back, perhaps in the dual-key style from Kevin Dudney's shed-style homes. Sell one. Pay down the debt, no doubt, rent the rooms, make one cash positive cash flow rental. That sounds almost ideal in many respects. This is the kind of transaction that most people are looking for. 1,065 square metres, as he says, as Noel and Caroline say here, the block size, the potential to knock down the house and build four townhouses. That's certainly possible in areas close to the city in Western Melbourne. All of the planning schemes, just one word of caution here though, all of the planning schemes in Melbourne are the same, in Victoria at least, they're all the same, all the councils are the same. The minimum lot size is 300 square metres, so you're immediately talking about a project here for four townhouses that's going to be below the minimum. Now that's going to mean that you are not going to get this through the council quickly. You may well get it through the council, but it's not going to be something that's going to happen in a few months. So if you're going to plan to knock down the existing house and not do the renovation, then you need to be doing a feasibility study that's going to allow for a fairly protracted period to get the four townhouses approved. Unfortunately, when you say Western Melbourne here, I'm not exactly sure which council you're talking about, so I can't really make any suggestions about whether they're good councils or bad councils in that respect. They're pretty much all good councils in Melbourne. I know that a lot of people complain about some of our councils, but in reality, the reason why they're complaining often is because they are going outside of the planning scheme, and that's certainly, if you're building four townhouses in Western Melbourne on 1,065 square metres, and you're going to be going outside the planning scheme. So by all means, complain if you have difficulties with the council, but just be aware that it is outside the planning scheme, so there's going to be difficulties, and you've also got to look at what's happening in the neighbourhood. If there are other similar developments in the neighbourhood, then you're not going to have too much trouble from the neighbours, and you're not going to get too many objections, and that's often what sorts the men from the boys when it comes to doing developments in Melbourne. It's not so much what the council say, but what the neighbours say, and the way the councils deal with the objections is probably the most important thing. In some cases, the council will say that if they get a lot of objections, they'll say that this is all too difficult and they'll reject the development application and leave the developer to take its VCAT. And that places the onus then and all the delays and all the costs on the developer. Some councils will simply say that if the development application fits within their guidelines, then they'll approve the development application and they'll leave the objectors to take the matter to the VCAT. And quite often when that happens, the objectors will fall away. They simply aren't that interested. So what separates the good councils from bad councils often is the way they deal with the objections, not so much the way they deal with the development applications. They go on to say, does this sound like a sensible crawl before you walk? Well, doing this kind of subdivision is actually, well, it sounds like a big project. It's actually not that complicated because what you're going to find is that you're going to only be dealing with two or three professionals or three or four professionals. You're going to deal with a town planner who's going to get the whole thing through the council for you. All you have to do is pay him money. Just keep paying bills. That's what's going to happen. He's going to, if you get the right town planner, they're going to bring their team to the table. They're going to bring their surveyors and all of their experts into play, and you'll just find yourself paying bills. You'll probably have to get an architect. Now, the architect, again, he's going to probably want soil tests and all those kinds of things, and he'll bring his team to the table and get all that done for you. And again, you're just left paying the bills. And once you get to the point where the development application has gone through the council, you start looking at things like building quotes and the building contracts and engineering drawings and all those kinds of things. Again, you're just going to be dealing with one or two professionals like builders, contract builders, who are going to get all that done for you. So while it sounds like a complicated project, often it's not, simply because you're going to be dealing with experts who are going to get this sort of job done for you. And so long as you pick the right experts, they're going to make it very easy for you. So long as you've got deep pockets and can keep paying them, they'll keep the project going. And but of course, once you start down this path, there's often no turning back. So you've got to be very, very careful about your due diligence and all of the issues in relation to financial feasibility study to make sure that you're going to come out on top at the end. Because the last thing you want to see happen is for the town planners, the architects and the builders make all the money and you end up with nothing. So financial feasibility, absolutely essential in this particular scenario. But it's also good to have a fallback, and your particular fallback is to renovate the front house. So you've got a plan A. If plan A is to knock down the existing house and build four townhouses, and that's your plan A, and you don't get that through council, then you've got a plan B, and your plan B is to do renovation at the front, put some dual locks at the back, and get that through. And now that may not necessarily, that may be more profitable, but it's a good position to be in, to have multiple plans and multiple strategies about the one property. The other thing you can do, of course, here is to get the whole process through council to build the four townhouses and then just flip it at that point. And what you might find is that you can do that in a relatively short space of time. If you can get the development application through council in 6 months and flip it and make a few hundred thousand dollars, that may be better than taking 2 years to build four townhouses and achieving a larger profit, but not a substantially larger profit, simply because a lot of the profits have gone to the builder. So it's certainly something that would be interesting, and it's very similar to the project I did as my first project. I didn't find it too hard. It was just something that you just needed to be confident about the professionals who were handling the job for you. He goes on to say, or they go on to say, if it's a good idea to do the cheaper, easier, hopefully less risky option, like the idea of trying to fit on low set rather than two-storey townhouses, and so on, and we think there is land to do it, should we push for this option or just go for the two-storey, which would be possible? This all comes down to your feasibility study, your economic feasibility study. You really got to do the numbers well on this kind of thing and go with the as your first option, go with the one that's going to deliver you the most amount of money in the shortest amount of time. And time is the factor. Time is the most important factor here. Certainly, if you can make $200,000 in 6 months, well, $200,000 in 6 months is a lot better than $300,000 in 2 years. You can do these kind of projects, getting plans through council and doing townhouses. You can do those in 6 months and do two of them in a year rather than one that involves construction in 18 months, then you're better off just repeating the whole process and becoming familiar with that whole development cycle. Once you've got the costs in place and you know what the costs are, repeating that process is a very, very simple thing to do. But that's what it comes down to: return on investment, cash on cash returns, but annualized. Figure it out how much you're going to make in the shortest amount of time. Also go on to say we also have trust and corporate trustees set up, just checking read the bank account here in Victoria. Australia-wide, when you're setting up a trust and a company or corporate trustee, the bank account should be in the name of the corporate trustee as trustee for the trust. So it will be ABC Proprietary Limited as trustee for ABC Trust. That's how your account bank account should be set up. Now that's all the questions. I haven't seen any other questions come through. Maybe I've been talking to myself for the last hour or so. I don't really know. It's the first time I've done this. Anyway, I'll hope that you're all still interested and all still listening. And I'd just like to do what Dipna suggests at this point and move on to just go through what I've done in terms of investing in the US. What happened in our particular case was that we did a townhouse development in Nidri in Victoria. We completed that in 2011. We made a pile of money, to be honest. The amount of money we made was the equivalent of my 7 years' salary, so we were quite pleased with the outcome from that particular project. And that left us in a position where we were debt-free. We had no debt at that stage. It's the first time probably in our lifetime that we'd actually owned our PPR, and it felt very good. And we were like that for all of 2 weeks, I think. And that was only because we went to the US, not because my wife went crazy with a credit card, but she did that too. But we decided at that point that we needed to look at how we were going to replace our income. And at the time, it seemed that we had a choice of two options. One was to go to the US and one was to invest in the mining towns. Now for us, at our age, I'm at retirement age, my wife is approaching retirement age. We thought that the ups and downs, the highs and lows of the mining town were not something that was something that we wanted to be too interested in. We didn't think that we could go and buy our groceries every week at Coles or Woolworths and say to them that, I'm sorry, we can't pay you this week because the mining town's rents have gone down. So that didn't seem to be an option. So we thought that it was going to be a little bit more steady income from the US. So that's where we went. This was the first house we bought. Now, this is... partway through the renovation process, as you can see, the windows are boarded up, but it was in the process of being renovated. It's what's called a bi-level. As you can see, there's windows down the bottom here, and that's because there's a basement underneath. So it has when you open the door, it has a walk-up and a steps down into the basement. And as you can see here, this is the kitchen. Everything's beige and white. It's just what they do when they're doing renovations in America. The bathroom has been replaced. This is the underfloor area with a new hot water service and new heating system. This is upstairs here from the door and the front window and the lounge room. And this is one of the bedrooms, built-in wardrobes. This is the street. As you can see, it's just an average kind of street. There's no drug dealers or gun dealers or liquor outlets or anything like that in the near vicinity. It's a nice quiet court, and it's just an average typical average American home. That was the financials for it. It cost us $54,000. It was fully renovated for $54,000, and a tenant moved into this pretty much within a week of us closing on the property. Now, this at the time we bought this, the exchange rate was $1.06. So in Australian dollars, it costs us a little bit less than $54,000, or at closing $52,600, it costs us a little bit less than that. And as you can see there, it rents for $795 a month. Everything here is in months, so we've allowed for maintenance and we've allowed for vacancy. And this problem, this particular property has not been a problem for us from day one. We've had a tenant in this house from the whole time we've owned it, which is now approaching 3 years we've had this property. It's been an excellent property for us. And as you can see, if we adjust the returns down to 90 cents, I think we're probably at 88 cents at the moment, our return on this one is approaching 14% at the moment in Australian dollars. The second one we bought is a similar property. It's a walk down into the basement, walk upstairs. This one has been a little bit of a problem for us. One of these trees in the front fell down and pulled up all the sewage. That happened in a storm. And then last year, one of these other trees fell down and took power off the house. And that was at a time, couldn't have been at a worse time, in fact, because at the time in this particular town, the whole city was in lockdown. The storm was so severe that any kind of movement was prohibited, and the tenant was trapped in the house with no heat, no power, and a meter thick snow and ice and sleet and blizzards going on, and the property manager had to get the emergency services to help them get out of the property, and that cost us a few thousand dollars to get fixed. So this has had its issues, but you know, nothing that you wouldn't necessarily get here in Australia in similar adverse weather conditions. Again, this property was in the process of being rehabbed at the time we bought it. Never had any difficulty with tenants in this particular property either, other than the issues in relation to storm damage. And as you can see here, this is a streetscape, nice wide streets, nice well-kept lawns. It's all kind of typical suburban area, relatively high degree of private ownership in this area. You know, when you're looking at areas in America, you've got to be careful about the types of areas that have a very, very high rental population. They tend to be in the lower socioeconomic areas, and they tend to be a little bit more unreliable in terms of investment properties. That was the financials. Similar price, $54,000 at closing, slightly higher rent, and that's been performing well too, other than the issues in relation to weather and the trees that seem to want to fall down. This was the next one we bought. Now, this particular house, as you can see, this is pre-renovation. Now, we didn't buy this property from the wholesaler. We bought this property directly from Wells Fargo Bank, and the price we paid for it was $12,250. So, you know, anybody thinks they can buy a house anywhere in Australia for that amount of money, well, please let me know. I'd like to know where it is. We then had to get a contract with the wholesaler to do the renovation, and they moved in and they did a complete renovation for us. Now, the renovation included replacing the kitchen, replacing the bathrooms. They redid a lot of the walls internally so that there were built-in wardrobes. They replaced the heaters, the air conditioners, all the window frames were replaced, the roof was replaced. It was a fairly substantial renovation by all accounts, and as you can see, it's been well painted. It's actually quite a nice place, and it's actually in an area, it's actually in Pittsburgh. Dimna always asked me never to mention cities, but I'll mention this particular city. It was in an area near what's called the Mexican War Streets. Now, you know, if you're thinking about investing in the US and somebody suggested that you buy something in the Mexican War Streets, it's not something that you would immediately think was a particularly good investment. But the Mexican War Streets is an area that is very, very yuppie, very, very trendy. And this is just outside that area to the north. It's very close to hospitals and very close to parks. And we've had a tenant in this place day one, and the tenants never missed a day's rent. We've only ever had one tenant call for maintenance in relation to this particular property, and that was because the next door neighbour's tree was growing over the fence. So this has been an excellent investment for us, very, very steady, and that's the price, as I said, $12,250 to purchase. We did pay a spotter's fee for it, so all up it cost us about $38,000, and it rents for $700 a month, and the tenants never missed a payment. So again, very, very pleased with this property. 16% return, slightly better now with the exchange rate. Just going back to that particular property too, one of the things that we learnt in buying properties in the US is that once you buy a property, you can actually appeal the what they call their county taxes, which is the same as our council rates. Because we paid such a low price for this particular property, it had been previously priced by the county at $70,000. So their rates or their county taxes were based on a property value of $70,000. We took that to an appeal process. It didn't cost us anything to do that. They have lawyers there who specialize in this particular process, and the lawyers charge you 50% of what they save you in the first year. So there was no money paid to them by us. And we had the property taxes reduced from something like, I think it was about $150 a month, down to $58 per month, just because we were able to challenge the fairly arbitrary value on the property value. It is actually something you can do here in Australia, but people don't do it. People aren't aware of it. We bought this property as well. This is in Texas. It's as you can see, it's a very nice house. It's in an area that's controlled by a homeowners association. The homeowners association provides all kinds of facilities like swimming pools. They have a lake. They have for people to sail on. They have bike paths. Access to this house is both from the front and the rear. There's a two-car garage at the rear. It's a typical American, middle American house. Very, very large bathrooms, very large kitchen here, as you can see. Very large lounge room. And it's a really nice property, and that's the street. Very, very nice street. It's a very, very good area. Now, this particular property cost us $150,000. This one, and in fact all of the properties that I've shown so far, have all been purchased in our self-managed super fund. We wanted this particular property because of its growth. We thought that the pre-GFC price in this particular property was $260,000. We were buying it for $150,000. We expected this to almost double in price in 5 years, and it hasn't quite come up to expectation in that respect. We've just had it valued because we're required to by our self-managed super funds, required to have these properties valued. We've just had it valued at $190,000. That's $190 US. And of course, $190,000 US at 88 cents is a lot more than $150,000 at 106. So capital gains perspective, it's done reasonably well in 3 years' time, although the cash flow returns have not been good. But again, we've not had any tenant issues. We've certainly had issues with the Homeowners Association. They've been very difficult to deal with. Little things like this tree, for example, in the front, it died. They fined us $75 because we didn't replace it quick enough. So, you know, you get to deal with homeowners associations. It's always a lot of fun. Then Sometime later, I went back to America again and I bought this. This is a block of six apartments. They're single bedroom apartments. Not the most pretty building you've seen, but it's in a relatively nice street, relatively nice area, close to hospitals. So a lot of worker, hospital worker type accommodation in the area for nurses and hospital employees. So not too much difficulty getting tenants in the area. That's the price. The entire block of six cost $115,000, and it's currently returning close to 18% with the exchange rate as it is at the moment. I've just had one little setback with this particular property, and one of my tenants died. Fortunately, he paid his rent before he decided to kick the bucket, but it was a little bit unfortunate that it was only after 8 days that the overpowering smell from the apartment became fairly obvious to his neighbours before they realised that he had died, and then it took us a few weeks to get the property back off the coroner, and it's not been particularly pretty, I guess. But nevertheless, as an investment, it's been a very sound investment for us. This is a block of four. Unfortunately, I don't have any photos in relation to this particular property. To be perfectly honest, I've never seen it. Ian has seen it. Ian Ugarte has seen it. I've never seen it. I bought this sight unseen. It's a very good property. It took a little while to get the first three properties were tenanted very quickly. The last one took a little while. It was it took about 6 months before I got the fourth tenant in there. But ever since that's been tenanted now, fully tenanted. Not one missed rental payment. And this is largely occupied by what the Americans call Section 8 tenants. Now, a Section 8 tenant is a welfare tenant. In most cases, anywhere from 80% to 100% of their rent is actually paid by the government. So it's government guaranteed rental. It goes into my bank account every month. Fortunately, in this particular state, the government hasn't gone broke, so they're paying it. But you've got to be a little bit careful with some of these Section 8 tenants, simply because I think the state governments have got less money than the tenants. But nevertheless, it's been an excellent property for us. It was a substantial renovation from top to bottom. Everything was replaced. All the heating systems, all the air conditioning systems, everything was replaced. And that's the reason $60,000 rehab cost. So fairly substantial renovation, but very, very high returns for this type of property. I then bought a property, which is this one. This is pre-renovation. Doesn't quite look like that now. Again, I bought this one sight unseen. Not recommended to buy property sight unseen. I bought these because I did have an associate in America at the time who went to see them for me and was able to give me good reports about the way the renovations were being done. And in this particular case, again, I've had absolutely no difficulty with the tenant. I've had the one tenant right from the outset. I have had some property management issues with this property and with the next one I'll show you. The property manager hasn't really been up to the task, so I've just changed the property manager. But the tenant has been very, very good. And this is it's a different street, believe it or not. It looks the same, but it's a different street. And that's the property in this particular street. This is pre-rehab. This pathway and everything was all redone. Everything's been rebuilt in this one. $57,000 it cost me. I've had some issues with this one. The tenant was dealing drugs. Not that we didn't actually find out they were dealing drugs out of the house, but they stopped paying rent. We started going through the eviction process. But before we could complete the eviction process, a SWAT team had turned up to arrest them and dragged them away, so it saved us having to get them out of the house. But they did do some damage in the meantime, and that's been a little bit of a problem for us, but it's now been, all those issues have been rectified, and hopefully have a tenant back in this place very soon. But this has probably been the only disappointment in the properties that we've owned, and that's simply because of one tenant and one poor property manager. And that's kind of the way our finances worked out, our financial summary. As you can see, our cash flow in all of these properties after interest is $66,000 currently. The estimated values, and some of these cases I've had these properties just valued recently simply because that's a requirement for the self-managed super fund to have the properties valued. So we're showing a capital gain there at the moment of close to $570,000 after 3 years. So we're very, very pleased with our investments in the US. Now, I haven't seen any questions, I don't think, unless I've been remiss. Sorry, there have been questions. I'll just go through some of the questions. Yes, you were supposed to be seeing the I Love real estate screen. You may probably used to be able to see the questions. That's probably something that Ian did, but he certainly didn't ask me to do it. So that's my inexperience in that respect. I apologise for not showing them. Pacific Law does exist in Victoria. They do have a gentleman who represents them in he operates in Box Hill. But if you've got issues, certainly go to Calvin and get them sorted out. Tanya has said, I'm going to my first auction this week. How does paying the deposit work if I'm successful? Do I need to contact the bank beforehand to let them know I need a bank check on the day? I've been successful at one auction and we just gave them personal checks on the day. There was no bank check needed. They just took personal checks. But if you've got those kinds of issues, just talk to the auctioneer before you actually bid and make sure that he understands that that's what you're going to do. And if there are any complications, then you can deal with them at the time. Just also, if you're going to an auction, and often something that people don't know, but often auctions are cash unconditional 30 days. There's absolutely no reason why you can't say to the auctioneer that if you're successful, you want a 60-day settlement. They are required to say that they've made that arrangement with you before the auction starts, but you can certainly do that if you want to. So make those arrangements with the auctioneer beforehand. Off the plan in Brisbane, knowing that it's going to increase, well, you don't know, basically. Unless you're familiar with what's happening in the marketplace when it comes to buying off the plan, what you really need to do with buying off the plan is to understand what is happening in terms of developments in the area. So if you've got a lot of development happening in the area, then and the market is going to be saturated with product, then the market is probably going to go down. So what you need to be doing is looking at all of the development approvals for townhouses or for apartments, whatever you're thinking about buying off the plan, and see what's coming onto the market and try and estimate what's going to happen to the market in the future. It's not something that you can do easily. You need to be listening to the experts in that particular case. Ben says, if you have every IP with a different bank, does this look bad when going to the next loan? No, it doesn't. One bank will never know what the other banks have, what you have with other banks. You're dealing with different entities in each case, so you needn't tell them, but your financial advisor, Investor Loans, will certainly help you with that. Kathy asks, I have never owned a property, have a full-time job now and can get a loan, living at parents' place now to have be able to save the deposit. Best thing to do in the Sydney market, want to live near work and daughter's school in the West. What's the best way forward? Well, unfortunately, Kathy, there's no easy answer to that question. One thing that I believe Dimna says, is that you should concentrate on buying your PPR first, try and buy it at a good price, try and look at your first PPR as an investment so that you can do, say, at the very least, cosmetic renovations, and in order to increase the value. Whatever you do, do not buy your dream home as your PPR and your first job, as your first property. It will lock you in and keep you poor. So look at your first property in terms of how it can take you forward, and a property that you can live in and renovate over time, and maybe even do a subdivision to pay down debt. Then that's your best option. So look at doing that as your first entry into the real estate market. Have not used a first homeowner's loan before. She says, I'm a school teacher supporting a 14-year-old girl. I sympathise with you. Can get a $500,000 loan, 97% of the loan. The 97% is probably going to require that you pay for mortgage insurance, but you know, if that's what it takes to get you into a property, then do it. Basically, that's just it's just another expense. So don't let that faze you. Buy the best property you can afford to buy, and buy it so that it's going to take you forward in terms of its capital growth and its potential for future development. So look at your first buy always in those terms. Victor asked, "What do I mean by flip it?" I mean just on sell it, basically. So if you're doing a deal like one of the questions that came up about building four townhouses, by flipping it, I mean get the thing through the DA process and basically end your involvement in the project there, on sell it to a developer who's got the money to actually do the construction, take the profit at that point. Just my apologies for not getting to these questions sooner. No, I'm not talking to myself. Thank you, David. I appreciate knowing that I'm not talking to myself. Wilson, how are you, Wilson? Good to see you here. Nice to have a lot of people on my webinars. I don't often get to talk to a lot of people on my webinars. Nobody listens. Sandra says, may I ask if you could tell us more about your Nidri project? My Nidri project was very simple. It was a 650 square metre block, absolutely dead flat. We split it down the middle, built two townhouses on it. We estimated we were going to sell them for $680,000 each. We sold them for $800,000 each in a rising market. We were lucky enough to buy low. We bought when the market was low. We sold when the market was at its peak. And it was, apart from the fact that it took us too long and it locked me into a transaction that took well over 2 years, it was an excellent project for us. I've got a question here from Haying Lim. I don't know how you pronounce your name, I'm sorry. Would you advise to still look at investing in the US? Yes, absolutely. People get phased about the exchange rate when it comes to looking at the US. The exchange rate at the moment is 88 cents in dollar. The long-term US dollar, Australian dollar exchange rate is 76 cents in dollar. So long as the exchange rate is above that, the chances are it's going to move in your favour rather than against you. So I would not be the slightest bit phased at investing more money in the US while it's still at the level that it's at. As it gets closer to 76 and the chances are that it's going to slide down below that, I'd be a little bit more cautious. But you've got to remember that if your strategy in investing in the US is to bring the money back to Australia in order to live on it, then you're going to be bringing it. You may be paying more for the properties now because the exchange rate is not quite so favourable as far as sending money offshore is concerned, but you're going to be bringing more money back. So it's the The amount of fluctuation in the Australian dollar from the point where you start that matters, whether the exchange rate goes up from 88 cents or down from 88 cents is going to determine whether you're worse off or better off. So that's basically where you're going to be risking your money. But the advantage is that if the exchange rate moves against you, then you can leave your money in the US, then leave it in the US until it moves in your favor, and then bring it back. And if you can do that, then you basically cover all risks. But I would certainly still be advising people to consider the US. It's not an easy market, but it's a rewarding market. Where can I find, Christine says, where can I find more information about properties requiring valuations in self-managed super fund? Any property that you buy in your self-managed super fund needs to be valued periodically. Generally, your auditor will tell you what they require in terms of property valuations. So, in some cases, in my cases, it was just letters from a real estate agent saying this is what the value was. There was no need to actually pay for anybody to go out and give a proper property valuation. But whether that applies in Australia or not, I'm not sure. But talk to your self-managed super fund auditor about getting property valuations. Sandra asked, what's a spotter's fee? In some cases in America, the wholesalers will find properties for you. They don't get involved in a purchase of the property, but so you buy the property directly from the banks or the owners of the property, and the wholesaler will ask you for a spotter's fee, basically a finder's fee for finding the property for you. Now, the wholesalers in Pittsburgh, for example, charge a set fee depending on the size of the property. If it's a single family home, they charge $7,000, I think. I can't remember exactly. If it's a multi, if it's a duplex, they'll charge $10,000. If it's bigger than a duplex, they'll charge $15,000. And then anything above four, they'll negotiate a fee, a spotter's fee. Traveling to the US, Andre asks, how many times do you need to travel to the US to buy a property? You need to go at least once. And that's mainly to set up a relationship with banks. It's almost impossible to open US bank accounts unless you're there. And you must travel overseas in order to establish your credentials as a foreign investor for the Australian tax system. So you need to go over at least once. And my recommendation is that you need to do some research beforehand with Dimnes Connections to find out which markets you should be in. And take the time over there to introduce yourself to all of the wholesalers in those markets so that you feel that you can trust them and work with them and buy property if you're in a position to buy property. Otherwise, at least if you feel that you know them and can trust them, then you can buy sight unseen. The Wendy has asked if I put the US places in my super. The first four were all in super and the second four were outside of super. Our superannuation, we had $300,000 in, well, actually we had less than $300,000. When we first went over to the US, we had $260,000 in super. We topped that up a little bit from the cash that we received from the NIDRI project and ended up spending about $300,000 inside super in the US and slightly more than that outside super. And I would, and Annie has asked if I would still buy property in the US, and definitely I would if I had the money. I've run out of money, which is a bit of a shame. Barbara asked, how do you do research to buy in the US? It's a difficult question to answer because it really comes down to your individual requirements. What I say to people is that when you think about or consider investing in the US, the first thing you need to determine is what your exit strategy is. If you want to invest in the US for a relatively short period of time and you want to exit from the US, say in 5 or 10 years even, then you'll be buying an entirely different property than a property you want to hold until you drop dead. It's simply that if you want to exit from the US market in 5 years, then you're going to need to buy properties that can sell in a retail market. And those properties will probably have some good cash flow, probably around 10 to 12% in terms of cash flow, but they'll probably also have some growth. If you're looking for a long-term investment, as I said, until you drop dead, then you'll probably be looking for multifamilies, high cash flow, but with very little chance that they'll sell in a retail market. So that's the kind of research you do. There's different cities you're dealing with. When you're dealing with Americans, you're dealing with 50 different economies. Every state is different. And you really need to talk about those kinds of investments that you want, whether you want some growth, some cash flow. You need to talk about those kinds of things with Dimner's American connections, and they'll send you to the cities that satisfy that particular requirement. Now, Michael has asked, how does taxation work in the US? Well, it would take me about an hour and a half to explain it. Taxation in the US is extremely complex between the two countries. Suffice to say that they do tax you. Generally, taxation in America is less than it is here. As a general rule, whatever income you earn in the US has to be declared in your Australian tax returns. So you are always going to be paying the greater of either the US tax rate or the American tax rate. The US tax rate or the Australian tax rate. Any income derive from the US is going to be included in your Australian tax returns, but you'll get a foreign tax credit and reduce your Australian tax liability by the amount of tax that you paid in the US. But this whole tax issue is extremely complex, and if you'd like to contact me, then do so, and I'll send you more details, but it's a little bit too complicated for this particular session. Ray has also asked if it's a good time to invest in the US. Yes, it is. There's still a lot of growth to be had. The growth has been much slower in the last 3 years than it was originally anticipated, simply because the US economy has not taken off. It's gradually improving, but not as quick as most people would have expected. So there's still plenty of opportunities in the US. Matt has asked if the rehab's done as part of the purchase. That's also a complex question. Basically, every wholesaler in the US operates differently. If you go to Chicago, in Chicago, for example, the wholesalers there, they offer you a complete turnkey product. You can buy a property that's fully rehabbed with a tenant. The property has a 12-month warranty. The tenant is also guaranteed for 12 months, the rent's guaranteed. That's one extreme. Or the other extreme is that you buy the property, the rehab is done as part of a second contract, and you basically have to go through the rehab process and then through the process of getting the tenant. So anywhere in between those two extremes is the way the different wholesalers work. So you just need to, again, talk to Dimner's connections, and they'll explain all those sorts of things. It just depends on your personal taste, what your requirements are, what your risk factors are. A lot more questions than I thought. When you have Simone has asked, when you have a property in the US, that means major renovation. Do you have a team? Yes, there are teams. All of the wholesalers have teams that do the rehabs. Generally, there they'll rehab to the standard that they expect for their tenants. So they're not necessarily what you and I would live in, and they're not what you and I would think to be a good rehab in some cases. But, you know, in many cases, in areas where you've got high cash flow, multifamily homes, then what you're talking about in terms of rehabs or renovations is perhaps lino and not carpet. And you know, those kinds of issues. There's no high, you wouldn't, in most of the American rental market, you would not be looking at high-end finishes in terms of renovations. Marianne has asked if all the houses in America were found through Dimner's group. Yes, they were. I've dealt exclusively with them. And Tessa has asked if the US properties can be purchased in the same type of trusts as Australian properties. Generally, when you're buying properties in America, you buy them in a limited liability company, not in a trust. They do have trusts in America, but they're entirely different animal to what we're used to. So you buy in limited liability companies. That whole issue of structure is something that you really need to do the Cashflow USA course in order to get a feel for that. Denise has asked if I can suggest accountants to do US tax returns. Denise, if you send me an email, questions at cashflowusagroup.com on the Cashflow USA website, then I'll send you my list of contacts, which will include all of the accountants who do US tax returns. Lingawati has asked, is it still worthwhile to do self-managed super fund if you're already 58 years old? Yes, it is. I was much older than that when I set up my self-managed super fund. But it also depends on how your self-managed super fund is performing now and whether you think you can do better. That's really what it boils down to. Cameron has asked if I'm available after hours to run through US numbers. Yes, I am. Contact me by email first and we can arrange a time to talk if anybody wants to talk specifics about the US. Generally, when people want to talk to me about the US, I send them a document first. It's a 26-page document which covers off most of the subjects so that we don't end up spending a lot of time on the phone talking about issues that are not relevant. Tanya has negotiated a 120-day settlement at an auction and a lower deposit than standard, and that's certainly what you need to do. There's absolutely no reason why you can't do that prior to an auction. Robin has asked, would you recommend or is it wise for first-time investor with low equity to start with or look at American market due to low purchase price? That's a personal choice, really. One of the things that you need to remember when investing in the US is that it is a cash market. The income from there is not going to be included in your serviceability for future loans in Australia, and you're not going to be able to leverage easily. There's very little loans that you can get in America. So basically, if you're investing in America, you're isolating your income and your money in America, in the American market. So you need to be a little bit careful about that, and best to speak to a financial advisor before you take that to go down that path. I've got a question here. Being brand new, it's really hard to know where to start. Could you give me a way to progress? Very hard to do that in this forum, unfortunately. Best to talk to Dimna or Ian when you've got some time, because it's a very, very personal thing. How to get started depends on your financial position, where you are, what your objectives are. Look, at this stage, I think we've probably well and truly over our time, and there's still a lot of questions here. I'm happy to answer any of your questions. If you want to send me an email, my email address is johnbone, that's johnbone, at optusnet.com.au, I think at this stage we'll call it a night. I'd love to answer all your questions, but there's just so many of them, we're just really out of time. So at this stage, I think I'll just wish you all good night. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope and haven't made too much of a mess of it. And good luck with your investing. And hope to hear from you soon.